So in 1635, in Boston, there lived a merchant by the name of Robert Kane. And by all modern standards, this Robert Kane fellow, he was a good man, and he was a successful business person. So he was a merchant, and his business, it was growing. He was making a healthy profit for himself. And he was a regular churchgoer, and he gave very generously to the church's ministries. He's the kind of person that many of us would want our kids to grow up to be like, if not the kind of person that we ourselves would want to be. So it may surprise you to learn that in 1635, the elders of the First Congregational Church in Boston, which is our flavor of Christianity, descended from the Puritans. We are nothing here if not puritanical. The elders of the First Congregational Church of Boston saw fit to hold a special meeting into which they called this Robert Kane guy. And they called him in order to admonish and discipline him. Now, why did they do that? They did that because 3 or 4 years earlier, these elders had decided that Christians should sell their wares for no more than a 4% profit. And it had come to light that this Robert Kane guy was selling his wares for a 6% profit. And so they called him into this specially held meeting in order to admonish and discipline him for the sin of greed. So where did they come up with this 4% figure that they were using to decide what is greedy and what is not greedy? Did it come out of the scriptures? Is it tucked away somewhere in the Old Testament? No. It is a 100% arbitrary distinction that they made. They got together and said, in our place, in our time, Boston 1635, charging any more than 4% profit means that you're greedy. Anything under that means you're not greedy. It's a line in the sand that they themselves came up with. And whereas from a modern perspective and the perspective of our crazily complex Facebook, Google, internationally linked up economy, from our perspective, the idea of drawing a stark line in the sand saying this is greedy and this is not, that seems like a crazy, if not just impossible, thing to do. From the perspective of today's reading from Matthew 6, that was a very smart thing to do. So if you're paying attention as Phil was reading, you would have noticed that Jesus lays out a series of 4 distinct teachings about our relationship to things in general and to money in particular. And if you were paying attention, it would have sounded like we were playing a game of one of these things is not like the others. Because 3 of these teachings are straightforward, they make sense on just an intuitive level, they're really easy to understand. So Jesus opens up by saying, don't store up for yourself treasures on earth where moth and rust destroys, but store up instead treasures in heaven. That's one teaching. That's pretty straightforward, pretty easy to understand. He then goes on to say that a person cannot serve 2 masters because you will love the one and you'll come to hate the other. Therefore, Jesus says, you cannot serve both God and money. That's another teaching. And then he wraps this whole thing up by saying, do not worry about a thing. Do not worry about your everyday life, because if God takes care of the birds flitting around in the sky, who do nothing to prepare for the winter, how much more is God going to take care of you? That's another teaching. Straightforward. Makes sense. But then plunk down in the middle of these 3 teachings, Jesus says what? He says, your eye is like a lamp for your body. If your eye is healthy, your whole body will be filled with light. But if your eye is unhealthy, your body will be filled with darkness. What? What does that have to do with anything, much less what does that have to do with money? Jesus seems to be here very wildly off message. What I want to argue this morning is that this is actually Jesus' most insightful teaching in this series of four teachings. And although it's articulated in a weird way, it's actually has a fairly simple meaning. The idea is that at this moment even, we have a little bit of light coming in our windows. We have light coming down from the chandeliers. We have these lights and those. The room is filled with light. And if our eyes are healthy, we're able to take that light into our bodies, and we're able to move around this sanctuary. We can work our way down the aisle. We can find our favorite pew. We can sidle our way in. We can navigate our way around the sanctuary. We can use our body in the way it was intended to be used because our eyes are healthy. So there's a very real sense in which if you have a healthy eye, your whole body is filled with light. If your eye is unhealthy, however, it doesn't matter how much light there is in the room, you're not going to be able to navigate your way through the sanctuary without stubbing your pinky toe on a pew. On your way out, you may trip and fall over the collection plate. As you do, I pray that you are nimble enough to throw a 20 in on your way down. If you're not, we'll still pick you up off the floor. We are a Christian church, after all. But in a very real sense, if your eye is unhealthy, your body is filled with darkness. You're not able to use it to navigate it out of where you currently are. So in the context of money and things, what does this mean? Jesus here is pointing to the fact that greed and materialism are unique among human vices. Of all the many ways that we fall short of the glory of God in our day-to-day lives, greed and materialism, they're the only vices to which we are completely, utterly blind. So compare materialism and greed to those much-loved vice of adultery. There ain't nobody in the course of human history who has been committing adultery and not known they were doing it, right? I mean, maybe if they get caught, they say, oh, oops, I didn't know I was doing that. But they're lying, that's not true. They knew full well what they were doing at the time. But that's not so with greed and materialism. Because all it takes to be blind to our greed, to be blind to our materialism, all it takes is to be standing next to someone who is a little bit better off than us and a little bit more materialistic than we are. And when we see that person, we're able to point at them and say, geez, I am glad I'm not like that person. They sure are greedy, aren't they? They sure are materialistic. And we don't see ourselves in that same light. Our eyes are unhealthy. And this is true, I think, for people in every tax bracket. If you're making $200 a year, you're pointing at the person who's making $2,000 a year. And you're saying, thank God I'm not as greedy as that person. If you're a multimillionaire, you're pointing at a billionaire, saying, oh, thank God I'm not as materialistic as that person is. I think the only people who don't do that are probably Bill Gates and Warren Buffett. They're the ones who don't really fall neatly into that equation. But everybody else, we have this amazing capacity to lie to ourselves, to fool ourselves, and deny the fact that we are indeed greedy and materialistic. And I recognize that is a hard sell. And that you will sit in this sanctuary today and you will nod your heads and then you will go out and go right back to denying it. So I'm going to offer you this little litmus test to determine whether or not you are greedy and materialistic, whether or not money has an undue significance in your life. Maybe it's more of a series of litmus tests. We'll start easy. We'll work our way down. So if you meet a rich person, when you meet a rich person, and in Boston this is an easy thing to do if you don't think it is, go over to Cambridge and walk down Brattle Street. You're bound to meet some rich people over there. But when you meet a rich person, are you enthralled with them when you meet them? Are you just interested in them because they have all this stuff? They have a big house, nice car. Are you enthralled with that person? Are you immediately jealous of the person when they pull up and they're getting out of a Porsche? Are you jealous? Do you want that for yourself? Or maybe when you meet a rich person, do they intimidate you? Does the simple fact that they have a lot of money, did you find them intimidating? Or the flip side of that coin, when you meet a rich person, do you automatically dislike them because you assume that because they're rich, they gotta be a jerk? They have to be corrupt. There's a lot of people, I think I'm a little bit like that. Are you like that too? And here's one I'm not gonna ask you to, you're not gonna have to out yourself on this one. Take this one home and think about this litmus test. But when you meet someone who is poor, much poorer than you yourself is, when you see a homeless guy sitting on the side of the street, do you think you are better than that person? Do you think you are better than that person? Do you think that maybe they don't work as hard as you do? Maybe not. They're not as smart and well-equipped as you are? Take that home. Think about that. That takes some serious introspection, I think, because no one wants to admit that about themselves. But maybe if you think about it long enough, you might be able to say, oh, well, that's at least a little bit true. But if you could answer yes to any of those questions, what that is telling you is that money is more to you than just money. Money is more to you than just something you can use to buy stuff. It has a bigger significance in your life. And it is changing, it is warping the way you view the world, and it's changing and warping the way you view the people around you. So, what is the cure? How do we move from having unhealthy eyes and bodies filled with darkness to having healthy eyes and bodies filled with light? How do we stop serving money and start serving God? How do we stop storing up treasure on earth? And how do we start storing up treasure in heaven? And the answer that I have for you this morning, I'm afraid, is going to sound equal parts trite and just predictable. And I apologize for that, I recognize it, but it's my job to tell you it nonetheless. I think the first step in this process, honestly, and I think this is true, trite as it is, predictable as it is, I think the first step in this process is to honestly just understand the gospel message. Because at the heart of this whole church thing, at the heart of this whole Christian faith, there is this story about a God who loves us so much that God gives up being God, takes on human flesh to live and suffer and to die. To what end? In that story, God is showing us what God treasures. And what does God treasure? It looks a whole lot like you, and it looks a whole lot like me. God, we're God's treasure. And if you just understand that story, if you just understand that truth, if you sit with it, let it do its work on you, you'll get to a point where you can begin to ground your life in that truth. And you'll be able to find your own significance in that love. You are significant already because you are so crazily loved by God. And if you really do believe that, then all of a sudden, you don't need to amass money and things around you to feel more significant, to feel more important, to feel better than other people. And all of a sudden, you don't feel the need to measure other people's significance by the amount of money and stuff they have. Because you'll see their significance also lies in the fact that they are loved by God. Trite and predictable as that message is, I think it's actually true. So as you leave today, I'm just going to invite you to think about that gospel message. Try to wrap your head around it just on an intellectual level. Because if you understand it long enough, I think you'll actually come to a point where you begin to believe it, you begin to trust it. And when you believe and you trust in that gospel love, it is going to change your life forever, and it's going to change that greedy little heart of yours forever too. Amen.